Good afternoon, and welcome to the Supreme Court Vacancy, What's Next? Conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. I will now turn the call over to your host, Jill Dash.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jill Dash. I'm the Vice President of Strategic Engagement here at the American Constitution Society. Thank you, everyone, for joining today's call, Supreme Court Vacancy, What's Next? Please note that today's call is being recorded and the recording will be available after the call. This call has been approved for 1.0 hours of California MCLE credit. In order to collect your credit, please email Matt Scoble at M as in Matt, Scoble, S-C-O-B-L-E at acslaw.org, and he will get you set up so that you can get your CLE credit. We will invite folks to ask questions at the end of the call, and we will go to press questions first, and that will be at the end of the call. I want to say welcome to all of our friends at the American Constitution Society, and for any of those of you who are not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. Turning to our call today, I must first apologize because Walter Dellinger is not able to join us after all. And although we will miss him, the good news is that we now have Dean Erwin Chemerinsky's undivided attention. ACS is incredibly fortunate to count Dean Chemerinsky as a member of our board of directors. Erwin Chemerinsky is the founding dean and distinguished professor of law and Raymond Pike Professor of First Amendment Law at the UC Irvine School of Law with a joint appointment in political science. He is the author of 8 books, including The Case Against the Supreme Court, which was published in 2014. He frequently argues cases before the nation's highest courts, including the United States Supreme Court. In January 2014, National Jurist Magazine named Dean Chemerinsky as the most influential person in legal education in the United States. Dean Chemerinsky holds a law degree from Harvard Law School and a bachelor's degree from Northwestern University. Welcome, Erwin, and thank you so much for joining us on this call.
It's my pleasure, of course.
So, Erwin, to begin, this vacancy comes to us under the unfortunate circumstance of Justice Scalia's passing. And obviously, much has been made of the possibility of a replacement nomination being made in an election year. Can you start by talking about the historical context for this vacancy and how Supreme Court nominations have been handled in the past?
Of course, and I think the place to start is actually with the text of the Constitution. Because what it says in Article 2, Section 2, Paragraph 2, is that the president shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States. And of course, it is says with the advice and consent of the Senate. So the Constitution creates a duty for the president to appoint Supreme Court justices by using the word shall. There is no clause in Article 2 that says, but not in an election year. I've heard some in the media say that the president doesn't have the power to fill a vacancy in an election year. That's, of course, silly. The Constitution has no limit. But that then provides the basis for answering your question directly. Presidents throughout American history have nominated in an election year the last year of their term. Most recently, in October 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower made a recess appointment of William Brennan to the Supreme Court. An example before that, in January 1940, obviously also an election year, President Franklin Roosevelt appointed Frank Murphy to the Supreme Court. In the debate on Saturday night, Anthony Kennedy's nomination and confirmation was mentioned. Just to be clear about that, Anthony Kennedy was nominated on November 11th, 1987. He was confirmed, though, in the election year, February of 1988. To go all the way back to the beginning of American history, to a very famous example, in 1801, John Adams nominated John Marshall to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Need to remember, of course, at that time, the new president was inaugurated on March 4th, and on January 20th, 1801, after it was already clear that Adams had lost his reelection bid, Adams nominated John Marshall, his Secretary of State, to be Chief Justice, and Marshall was confirmed 1 week later on January 27th. Overall, over the entire course of American history, 24 times presidents have nominated individuals in an election year. Sometimes that was with presidents who were seeking reelection, sometimes not. And in 21 of 24 instances, the nominee has been confirmed by the Senate. That's 87.5%. If you look at the entire course of American history and all presidential nominations for the Supreme Court, 86.9% have been confirmed. So there's no statistical difference between nominations in the last year of presidency and nominations that come in any other time of the presidency. The example that I've heard mentioned in the media that shows that the Senate doesn't have to confirm goes way back in American history to the time that John Tyler was president, and there was clearly strong disagreements in 1843 and 1844 between Tyler and the Republicans. The interesting thing there is Tyler made six nominations to the Supreme Court, and that includes nominating Judge Edward King twice, and in four of the six, the Senate did take some sort of vote. So there's some precedent for the Senate not voting there, but overall the Senate was still voting on the Tyler nominations. So the president has the authority to nominate, and the Senate then gets to decide. I think that you can plausibly read Article 2 to say that the Senate has the duty to advise and consent. I think that the Constitution would make no sense if the Senate could just leave a vacancy indefinitely, but I think it's something that isn't enforceable by the courts. No one can sue the Senate to force them to hold hearings. No one can sue the Senate to force them to take a vote. I think the question will be, would there be sufficient political pressure on the Senate to force them to hold hearings or take a vote? I hope that answers the initial question.
I think it does. So now we have an 8-member court. Can you talk a little bit about how that works when we have an 8-member court? What does that mean for cases this term? What does it mean going forward?
Sure. And of course, it's not unusual to have an 8-member court. Sometimes it occurs because a justice is recused. I think here of Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin, the affirmative action case that was argued on Wednesday, December 9th. There was an 8-member court there because Justice Kagan was recused by virtue of her involvement in the case as Solicitor General. Now it's a 7-member court, and I want to come back and talk about what might that mean. Sometimes there's an 8-member court because a justice is ill. In the 2004-2005 term, when William Rehnquist was ill, he didn't participate in a number of the cases that year, and there was an 8-member court. And sometimes it's because vacancies are unfilled. I think here of the 1987-88 term, where after Robert Bork was rejected, Douglas Ginsburg's nomination was withdrawn. It wasn't until February that Anthony Kennedy was confirmed. So that court proceeded with an 8-member court for most of the term. As I think everyone on the call knows, when it's an 8-member court, so long as it's 80-71-6253, it's no problem. The question, of course, is what if it's a 4-4 tie? And one thing that, again, I'm sure everyone on the call knows, but I've heard a lot of misinformation in the media, a justice can participate in a decision only if he's on the bench at the time the ruling comes down. So for any of the cases that have already been argued, that have already been voted on in conference, Justice Scalia will not be participating in those decisions. The most recent example where this occurred was in the October 2005 term, 2005-2006. Sandra Day O'Connor stayed on the bench until Samuel Alito was confirmed. But there were three cases that term that would have been 4-4 without her participation. All three of those cases were re-argued with Justice Alito on the bench. In none of those cases did Justice O'Connor participate because she couldn't be part of a ruling if she wasn't on the bench at the time. The Supreme Court then will have two choices, well, really three choices, with regard to the areas of split 4-4. One is they could reconsider the case and see if there is some ground upon which a majority might agree. Maybe there's some narrower ground that the majority could agree to. Maybe there's a procedural ground to resolve the case. Assuming they can't break their 4-4 tie, then the second possibility would be that they would affirm the lower court without opinion by an evenly divided court. And this has happened many times in American history. There have been just 8 justices. They simply announce they're affirming the lower court without opinion by an evenly divided court. And one place where many people expect that might happen is a case that was argued on Monday, January 11th, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. That, of course, involves the question whether it violates the First Amendment to force non-union members to pay the share of the dues that go to support collective bargaining. Rarely have I read a transcript of an oral argument that seemed clearer as to the result. It seemed that there was going to be 5-4 to overrule Abood versus Detroit Board of Education and hold that non-union members cannot be forced to pay the share of the union dues that go to support collective bargaining. But Justice Scalia was part of the 5-person majority. Without him, it's 4-4, and the court could decide to affirm the Ninth Circuit by an evenly divided court to wait and let the issue come back before it in another case. Another place where many people speculate that could happen is a case that will be argued in April, United States versus Texas. This involves President Obama's immigration action. They announced in November 2014 Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, DAPA. Many think that it will be 4-4 without Justice Scalia. In fact, just a week ago yesterday, the Supreme Court 5-4 issued a stay with regard to the Environmental Protection Agency's climate regulations, the coal-fired plant regulations. Justice Scalia was in the majority there. Many think that that might predict the court's attitudes towards executive power, and that the court might have come out 5-4 against President Obama on immigration. Without Justice Scalia, it's 4-4, and their affirming by an evenly divided court would mean that the Fifth Circuit decision upholding a preliminary injunction against the Obama immigration plan remains in effect. And I intentionally took one example where the liberals would be pleased to have a 4-4 affirm without opinion, and one where the conservatives would be pleased. I think that there's a couple of interesting wrinkles with regard to this 4-4. One is, what about Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin? Now there'll be 7 justices participating because of both the absence of Justice Scalia and Justice Kagan. The court certainly could issue a decision 4-3. There have been other examples of 4-3 decisions. There's a quorum. But especially if this is a major limit on affirmative action, will the court want to do that by a 4-3 margin? That's not a legal question. It's a question much more in terms of what the court believes is appropriate in such a controversial area. Now, the other question with regard to 4-4 split is, what about the areas where there's a split among the circuits? How will the court feel about affirming by an evenly divided court where the lower courts are divided? Because then affirming the lower courts means that the same federal law will have varying meanings in different parts of the country. And the instance where this comes to mind is a case that's going to be argued in March, Zubik versus Burwell. This involves the contraceptive mandate under the Affordable Care Act is applied to not-for-profits that are affiliated with religions. There, 7 circuits have upheld the contraceptive mandate, rejecting the argument that it violates the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. 1 circuit, the 8th circuit, has come out the other way. If the Supreme Court affirms the 7 cases before it by an evenly divided court, and the 8th circuit case is still there the other way, well, you then have the same statute with varying meanings in different parts of the country. The court, when there's these kind of circuit splits, might be reluctant to see that happen. So that leads to the final possibility. If the court can't find a narrower way of deciding and they're not going to affirm by an evenly divided court, they could put the case over for re-argument next term. The court always has the ability to put a case over for re-argument. The court has done that in some very prominent cases in the past. Brown versus Board of Education was argued in the 1952 term, put over for the 1953 term, the summer in between, Chief Justice Fred Vinson died. Earl Warren was a recess appointment to the Supreme Court, and that certainly changed history. Roe versus Wade was argued and then put over for re-argument. Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission was argued and put over for re-argument. So I think we could imagine that the court could decide to put over some of these cases, have them argued again next term. That then goes to the question of how likely is it will there be a ninth justice next term, and how likely is it that the president will be able to get somebody confirmed. If the president's nominee is not confirmed by the Senate before January 20th, and the new president makes the nomination then, there would still have to be Senate hearings, and it seems unlikely that the new nominee would be able to be present for many, if any, of the oral arguments next term, which means that the court would be functioning next year with eight justices. That could very well affect what kind of cases it chooses to take. I've done some reading about how long are vacancies, in case anybody's interested. The longest vacancy that I could ever identify of a seat in the Supreme Court was 391 days. Abe Fortas resigned on May 14, 1969. His successor on that seat, Harry Blackmun, wasn't confirmed until June 9, 1970, and that's because the Senate rejected the two individuals that President Nixon first named to replace Fortas. So there have been long vacancies. This would be one of the longest, if not the longest, if the Senate isn't willing to confirm who President Obama nominates.
I want to follow up a little bit on the re-argument line. How is re-argument decided? Can any justice decide that a case should be re-argued? Is there a vote? Is there some kind of quorum that's needed?
The rules are very murky on this. I mean, generally, any action of the Supreme Court, except for the grant of certiorari, takes a majority of the justices. So, for instance, issuing a stay takes a majority of the justices. It's only granting cert that is for. On the other hand, there's an enormous amount of courtesy that justices give to one another. My guess is that the justices here are going to work out among themselves how to decide whether to have re-argument. Usually it only takes four votes to grant cert, and isn't re-argument in a sense like granting cert. On the other hand, should this be seen as the kind of procedure where it does take a majority? So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what the court does in that regard.
And is it the case that the Chief Justice can order something for re-argument as much as any other Associate Justice?
Sure. Well, again, the court has ordered re-argument before. Let's take the Citizens United case. There's been a lot written on how the court came to order re-argument for Citizens United. What we don't know is what was the vote count there for re-argument. This, like so many aspects of the Supreme Court, is invisible to the public. There isn't very much candor for the Supreme Court with regard to that.
A couple final questions, and then we'll open it up to our audience. You talked a little bit about what happens if we have an extended vacancy creating an eight-member court, and then in some cases, depending on recusal, a seven-member court. At what point would you refer to this as a constitutional crisis? Is it an eight-member court? Is it a seven-member court?
The reason I pause is what the word crisis means. I mean, the court is not going to be able to do its constitutional duty if it goes a long period of time with just eight justices. Let me go back to the contraceptive mandate example. We can come up with many others. If the circuits are split and the justices are divided 4-4, there's no way to resolve that difference among the lower courts. The Supreme Court would say one of its most important functions is resolving disagreements among the lower courts. Federal law should have the same meaning everywhere in the country. And yet, what you'd have is a federal statute having varying meanings in differing circuits. That's, in a sense, a constitutional crisis. On the other hand, I don't know what the word crisis means. The country would still function in those circumstances. The court just isn't going to be able to do what it's supposed to be doing if it has only eight members.
Thank you, Erwin. Well, as always, this has been a fantastic explanation of what we have before us. At this time, I'd like to ask the moderator to open up the lines for questions, and if the audience could allow members of the press to ask questions first. So if you're a member of the press, go ahead and ask your questions.
The lines are now open for questions. If you would like to ask a question, you can do so by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We will pause just a moment for the Q&A roster.
While we're waiting for that, Erwin, can I ask you one further question?
Of course.
Do you think that the situation that we now find ourselves in is potentially an argument for having term limits of our justices on the Supreme Court?
As I've been outspoken, I believe there should be 18-year non-renewable terms. I don't think that this situation argues one way or the other. Even if you have 18-year non-renewable terms, there will be justices who tragically die in the middle of the term. I think that there will also be situations where a particular vacancy seems unusually pivotal. I think the reasons for having 18-year non-renewable terms is in part about life expectancy. Life expectancy, thankfully, now is much longer than it was. Clarence Thomas was 43 years old when he was confirmed for the Supreme Court in 1991. If he remains on the bench till he's 90, that's 47 years as Supreme Court Justice. That's too much power in the hands of one person for too long a period of time. Also, too much now depends on the accident of history, is when vacancies occur. Obviously, in that sense, this vacancy reflects that. If we had 18-year non-renewable terms, every 2 years a president would get to fill a vacancy. And so I think that less would depend on when does the particular vacancy occur. Richard Nixon had 4 vacancies to fill in 2 years. Jimmy Carter had no vacancy to fill in 4 years.
Thank you. Tammy, do we have any questions?
We do. Our first question comes from Ariane DeVogue. I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong. Your line is live.
Hi. I just wanted to see, did I misunderstand? I don't remember with Rehnquist. Did he actually, I know he wasn't on the bench, but did his vote not count in a few cases? And on affirmative action, when you were talking about a major shift, would you, or a major ruling, would you include in that if they simply overturn the Texas plan just narrowly on, say, the 10% program? I just want to make sure I understand what you're considering sort of a major ruling there.
The first is the easier question to answer. William Rehnquist passed away in September of 2005. So it was before the October 2005 term began. All of the cases that were handed down the prior year, he was still a justice on the court.
Yeah,
it's left up to each justice to decide if he or she is not on the bench on the day of argument, whether to still participate in the decision. Rehnquist did not attend many of the oral arguments that term, and as far as I know, he didn't then participate in the decisions in those cases. At least, I mean, I can think of a case I argued that term where he was not on the bench at argument and did not participate in the decision. But that's very different than the situation where I'm talking about, where a justice was on the bench, did participate in the vote in conference, but then was not on the bench at the time of decision. Then they can't participate in the ruling. In the example I gave there was Sandra Day O'Connor participated in arguments in the fall of 2004, but for cases where she wouldn't be on the bench when the cases came down, her vote did not count. In terms of Fisher, I mean, it's obviously a qualitative question. I think the more the court sees itself as changing the law of affirmative action in a significant way, the harder it will be for the court to want to do that 4-3. But there's a qualifier there. Assume that the next justice is appointed by President Obama or a Democrat and is likely to join with Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. That then would produce a 4-4 split in the Texas case, which means they wouldn't be able to resolve it anyway. If it's a narrow ruling, like Texas didn't do enough to prove there's no race-neutral alternative, then I think the court would be more inclined to do it 4-3. If it's a ruling, say, to overrule Grutter versus Bollinger, I don't think they'd want to do that 4-3, because then there's the real possibility that in the next case where Justice Kagan's not recused, and if there's an Obama or a Democratic nominee, it'd be 5-4 to quickly overrule the decision, overruling Grutter. And I don't think the court would want to go down that path. So I think the answer to your latter question is, it really depends on what the court perceives as the narrowness or breadth of its decision with regard to Fisher.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from Mark Welsh. Walsh, your line is live.
Hey, Erwin. Mark Walsh from I cover the court for the ABA Journal and Education Week. And the to go back to the question of 4-4 tie and whether to just uphold the lower court or call for re-argument, I've just really been wondering about that dynamic. And today, you brought up the Friedrichs case. Today, the people who you know, represent the teachers in the Friedrichs case called for, you know, re-argument if it's 4-4, and presumptively, you know, presuming it probably is at this point. And if not, they would even seek rehearing, which is quite rare. But what, you know, people talk about politics on the court. What would be the dynamic for the court to call for re-argument when that's, I think, a pretty clear case what the outcome would be one way or the other?
And, of course, this is going to be one of a number of cases where that's so. This is the one where we think from the oral argument that it's got there. But what about Evanwell versus Abbott that was argued on December 8th about how to do districting? What if that was a 5-4 decision? And, of course, projecting to the future, what about the abortion case, Whole Woman's Health Center versus Cole, that's going to be argued, or the immigration case, United States versus Texas? I've wondered whether the justices will come to some consensus among themselves overall about how to deal with this whole set of cases rather than make individualized decisions to say, we'll put over all of these cases, or we'll affirm all of them 4-4. The other possibility is that they will, on an individualized basis, decide whether to affirm by an evenly divided court or whether to hold oral argument. Friedrichs is so much the focus because it seemed so obvious in the oral argument that there were 5 justices to overrule Abood and say that non-union members don't have to pay the fair share of the collective bargaining costs. The thing about Friedrichs, unlike some of the other areas, though, is if the Supreme Court dismisses Friedrichs affirms the Ninth Circuit in Friedrichs by an evenly divided court, the law remains the same as it was and has been since 1977, that there's no split among the circuits on this issue, and those who brought the Friedrichs case can certainly bring another lawsuit to do the exact same thing. The problem for them, though, is that if it is an Obama pick or a Democratic pick for the court, it's likely going to be 5-4 to affirm Abood. But if it's a Republican who gets to pick, it's going to probably be 5-4 to overrule Abood. So the timing and who's on the court at the time will make all the difference. Does that get your question, Mark?
Certainly, sure. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Greg Stower. Your line is live.
Hi, Erwin. Back on the subject of what the Senate has to do, some folks are, including Ilya Soman on the Volokh conspiracy today, are making the point that there's another provision of the Constitution that says each House of Congress may establish its own rules. And the argument is basically that it can effectively deny consent to a nominee by not even taking a vote. What do you make of that?
I want to separate here the ways in which we can argue what the Constitution means from how the Constitution is enforced, because it's really the latter question that matters so much more than the former question. The latter question is, if the Senate chooses not to bring a nominee for a hearing and not to have a vote, is there any legal way to force them to do so? And I think the answer to that is no. There's no court that's going to say that the Senate Judiciary Committee has to hold a hearing. There's no court that's going to say the Senate has to take a vote. So the only enforcement mechanism is the political one. Now, in terms of the textual argument, yes, of course, the Constitution says that each house can make its own rules. It also says, as I pointed out, that when the president nominates, the Senate shall give advice and consent. My response to the textual argument is that the very basic principle of separation of powers is that no branch can use its powers to interfere with the functioning of another branch of government. That's what the Supreme Court says so clearly in United States versus Nixon. So I think the argument would be that the Senate can't make rules that would undermine the functioning of the judiciary. What if, in a prolonged fight between the President and the Senate, that the Supreme Court is below a quorum and can't function at all? Isn't at some point that clearly interference with the judicial function, violation of separation of powers? I think the answer to that is yes, but saying that it violates the Constitution still doesn't go to what I think is the more important latter question. How do you then enforce that? And I think here it would have to be the political process. I don't think it's something that the court could enforce. So I don't think pointing to that provision in the Constitution really matters in terms of the constitutional analysis, and most of all, I don't think it matters in terms of the question of how is the Constitution enforced.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from Christine Kippens. Your line is live.
Hi. I have a question about re-argument and what it means. Does it only mean that the case will be argued this term and then scheduled for re-argument instead of issuing an opinion, or might it also mean that the argument will be rescheduled for next term before or instead of hearing arguments this term?
That would be up to the court. I would be very surprised if the court takes cases off of the oral argument calendar and then puts them over to next term instead. That's in the discretion of the justices to do. My expectation is for all of the cases that are scheduled for argument, arguments will be held, the justice will vote in conference, and then decide what to do. I base that, for example, on when William Rehnquist wasn't on the court and there was the possibility of 4-4 ties. They still had oral argument, though there were some cases where there were 4-4 ties that they dismissed for an even light of court, or they could put over for re-argument. And I mentioned examples of that when Senator O'Connor left the bench. If they put the case over for next term, then generally that it will just be on the argument calendar. I think here of what they did with regard to Citizens United. They asked for new briefing and new argument. They actually scheduled the argument for Citizens United before the beginning of the term. They had it heard in early September because they wanted to provide guidance with regard to the coming election. Brown versus Board of Education, Roe versus Wade. So many cases have been re-argued. But I think the bottom line answer to your question is the expectation would be for any of the cases this term, they will hear oral argument is scheduled. After the argument, they'll decide if they're split 4-4, whether they're affirmed by an evenly divided court, or put it over for re-argument next term.
Our next question comes from Rebecca Wolf. Your line is live.
Hi. I have a question about recess appointments. Could you talk about those, and is the Senate required to affirm after an appointment by the president during a recess?
Sure. What's interesting is that up until June of 2014, we had no law from the Supreme Court interpreting the constitutional provision about recess appointments. And then in June 2014, the Supreme Court decided NLRB versus Noel Canning. And there the Supreme Court said, reversing the D.C. Circuit, that the president can fill an intra-session vacancy with a recess appointment, but it has to be a vacancy that's more than 9 days. It has to be a recess that's more than 9 days. And to answer your specific question, if there's a recess appointment, it lasts until the end of that session of Congress, and then the recess appointment expires, then the president could, whoever is president, reappoint that individual, appoint somebody else. Prominent recess appointments to the Supreme Court have happened. As I mentioned earlier, Earl Warren and William Brennan were both recess appointments to the court. Earl Warren presided over the oral arguments in Brown versus Board of Education while he was a recess appointment to the Supreme Court, later to be confirmed by the Senate, of course. And William Brennan was a recess appointment right before the election. He was appointed in October 1956, later confirmed by the Senate. Other than the current recess, and I don't expect President Obama to make a recess appointment, my prediction is that the Republicans in the Senate will make sure that there's no recess appointments just by not going into recess, doing what both Democrats and Republicans have done, quickly call the empty chamber into session, then adjourn it and say, we're not in recess. And that's, of course, exactly what was the factual underpinning of NLRB versus Noel Canning.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Andrew Kirtley. Your line is live.
Yes, I have a question about how if four justices vote for summary affirmance and four justices vote for re-argument, how that would be resolved.
It's a 4-4 split, and that means that the court is tied, and the effect of that, as anything else, is the court can't act if it's tied. And so I think in that instance what you have is, unless the justices would show courtesy to one another, the lower court gets affirmed by an evenly divided court. 4-4 can't do anything on the Supreme Court. Though I predict in this situation that there'll be a lot of courtesy to the justices to each other, and trying to find consensus as to procedures. But we'll see. And one of my concerns in this regard, and your question goes directly to it, is how much will we know and how much will the Supreme Court do in secret? It's always troubled me, for example, we don't know who votes which way on cert grants or cert denials. And will we know who votes for rehearing and who votes to affirm by an evenly divided court? But 4-4 is an impasse.
Our next question comes from Joseph Williams. Your line is live.
Hi, guys. Thanks for providing this call. I'm with U.S. News and World Report, and I apologize I missed part of the early call. Irwin, I'm just wondering if you could, I hate it if you're repeating yourself, but if you just kind of go over and give thumbnail sketches of the important cases you see on the docket that are in the balance right now because of the vacancy.
Sure. Of the cases that have been argued already, I think some of the most important are the redistricting cases, Evanwell versus Abbott, which focus on whether districting is to be done on the basis of eligible voters or on the basis of population. There is the Arizona districting case that involves how much deviation is permissible from one person, one vote, and can politics be a basis for it? There's Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin, argued on Wednesday, December 9th, as to whether Texas made an adequate showing that there was no race-neutral way to achieve diversity. I'd say Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association that we've been talking about that was argued on January 11th as to whether non-union members have a First Amendment right not to pay the share of the dues that go to support collective bargaining. I'll mention one case that hasn't gotten media attention where there could be a 4-4 split without Justice Scalia. It's a very important case with regard to standing, Spokio versus Robbins, that was argued back in October. This involves an internet search engine, Spokio, and a man by the name of Robbins typed his name in and found some inaccurate information. He sued under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which allows damages up to $1,000 for intentional inaccuracies. And the question is, does he have standing to sue? The underlying issue is, can Congress, by statute, authorize an injury standing that otherwise wouldn't exist, or does he have to show some real-world injury? That's a case of huge importance to business and more generally for federal courts. Of cases still to come up, ones that I've mentioned, Zubik versus Burwell, in terms of whether the contraceptive mandate is applied to nonprofits affiliated with religion, violates the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Whole Women's Health Center versus Cole. This is the Texas law that imposed restrictions on abortion, requiring that doctors who perform abortions have admitting privilege at local hospitals in 30 miles, and that any facilities where abortions are performed are surgical quality facilities. And, of course, the United States versus Texas, which was the challenge by Texas and 25 other states to the Obama immigration plan, the deferred action for parents of Americans. And I point to those because least plausibly, there'd be 4-4 splits, other than obviously Fisher, where Justice Kagan isn't participating.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Len Simon. Your line is live.
Hello, Erwin. How are you?
Hi.
I have a question about filibusters, and I'm not sure it's a constitutional question, a political question or what, but I wonder if you could talk about the extent to which Obama will need 50 votes or 60 votes in order to get a confirmation of a justice.
I think that's such an important question because, in theory, if the Democrats could get 4 Republican senators to join them, they would then have a majority to confirm the nominee. And it's interesting to think about, could that majority force the Senate to hold hearings? Could that majority force the Senate to take a vote? That majority would seem to be enough to confirm. On the other hand, we all know that in the Senate, the filibuster exists. So where the filibuster exists, it effectively takes 60 votes. Now, the Senate changed its rules a few years ago to eliminate the filibuster for lower federal court judges in their appointments, and also for appointments to certain agencies, but not for Supreme Court justices. So in this hypothetical where 4 Republicans were willing to join the Democrats and there was a majority, you could then have a filibuster led by the other Republicans to block this. The Senate rules would permit that. There's no history in the United States of filibustering Supreme Court nominees. There were 48 votes against Clarence Thomas, but the Democrats didn't filibuster. There were 42 votes against Samuel Alito, but the Democrats didn't filibuster. The closest you come as a precedent is with regard to Abe Fortas. There were 2 cloture votes that failed with regard to Abe Fortas. And so you could say really there it was a filibuster, but it was a much more complicated story. If the Democrats had the majority of the Senate and the Republicans filibustered, the Democrats could change the Senate rules to eliminate the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees, just like they changed the rules to eliminate the filibuster for lower federal court judges. I think that with the Republicans in control of the Senate, that just procedurally never could happen. So the answer to your question is, in the event that 4 Republicans would join the Democrats to create a majority, Senate rules would still allow the senator, the 40 Republican senators, to filibuster, and I don't think there's anything the Democrats could do about it.
I have no further questions in queue at this time.
Okay, well, Erwin, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for walking us through these complicated but very pressing issues. Before everyone leaves us today, I want to thank everyone on the call. And if you are interested in this topic and want to know more, please follow ACS on social media, both our Facebook and Twitter presence. Also, check back on our website. We'll be having ACS blog posts on the subject, as well as other resources on the website. If you're really interested in the subject, we would welcome you to write letters to the editor of your local newspaper or perhaps place an op-ed. And if you need help with that, please contact the ACS staff and we'll be happy to help you. And thank you everybody for your time.
Thank you.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect your lines.